Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
This audio presentation contains graphic details of death, violence, and controversial subject matter. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From Dead Souls Media, this is The Satanic Murder of Arliss Perry. I'm Jamie Black, a researcher and psychologist, and I'll be your host for tonight. Good evening, everyone. I hope you all had a great holiday season. We have a bit of a true crime episode for you tonight. It's one that I have touched upon briefly in the past, but I'd like to go into more detail about it this evening. Because as far as murder cases go, this one is rarely talked about these days. Maybe because it was considered an isolated case for so long. Maybe because it happened way back in 1974 and received very little fanfare. Who knows? But one thing is for sure, however, that this murder case has more significance than it appears to, at least on the surface. Now, we are all aware of the satanic panic of the late 70s, 80s, and 1990s, a cultural panic that swept Western Christian countries, but had the most significant impact upon the United States. Well, it would be easy to dismiss this case as another that makes up the bibliography of the satanic panic. But I think that judgment would be premature. There is no denying that the 1970s saw a cultural shift, and you could say, for lack of a better phrase, that the 70s were profoundly witchy. And what I mean by this is that the decade could be characterized by an occult explosion, an explosion that brought witchcraft, paganism, and esoteric spiritual ideas from the underground into the mainstream pop culture of the day. A rejection of traditional, patriarchal belief systems led many to explore alternative spiritualities, including Buddhism and witchcraft, which offered a deeper connection to nature. A second wave feminism in the late 1970s saw activists reappropriating the image of the witch as a symbol of female power, independence, and political rebellion. The media of the day, as it always does, reflected the cultural intrigue with films like The Wicker Man and Blood on Satan's Claw, and of course, Luigi Scattini's Mondo documentary Witchcraft 70, which was a film about satanic rites from around the world, including devil-worshipping, voodoo cults, the Church of Satan, black magic, and pagan rituals. But it also influenced literature, such as the Man, Myth, and Magic Encyclopedia. The 1970s were also a pivotal time for modern paganism and Wicca, with figures like Alex and Maxine Sanders bringing, at times, theatrical and public attention to the practice. Well before the mainstream digested the witchcraft and occult explosion and summarily became fearful for their children, a large proportion of the US, Britain, Canada, continental Europe and Australia embraced it at large. That naturally led to dark acts and sinister deeds. Tonight's case could very well fit into this narrative. A real-life satanic cult, devil worship, and ritualistic human sacrifice. But as always, let's start at the beginning and take in the facts. Arliss K. Dykema was born on February 22, 1955 in Linton, North Dakota, to Marvin Dykema and Jean Van Beek. Marvin served in the US Army during the Second World War before working at Chase Chevrolet for more than 20 years. Whilst her mother Jean was a homemaker. Arliss was the youngest of three children, with an older sister Karen and an older brother Larry, who was born in 1950. As devout Christians, the Dykemas planned and started the Bismarck Reformed Church, which is now known as the Bismarck Community Church. The family founded the church in 1957. Alice was described as a devout Christian, much like her parents. She was well known in her hometown for her very optimistic, compassionate and kind nature. She had a sheltered upbringing that possibly moulded her to become overly trusting and slightly naive. In 1973, Alice graduated from Bismarck High School, where she excelled academically. She also actively participated as a cheerleader and was a member of the Fellowship of Christian Athletes.
She was always smiling, always so happy.
This is Sue DeCoch, and this is what she had to say about Alice, a friend of hers from her hometown of Bismarck.
She was always upbeat, always positive. She had such a bubbly personality.
Alice expressed her kindness by baking cakes for her fellow cheerleaders and the high school's basketball team. She was much liked in Bismarck. During her time at high school, she developed a close relationship with her high school sweetheart, Bruce Perry. She was a petite girl, but with a big heart, which is why Bruce became so enamored with her. Bruce was a track star who held the all-time state record for the quarter-mile run and tied the state record. The young man was not only dedicated to his athletics, his studies were also extremely important to him, and friends noted he was quite the scholar. Bruce's family were a prominent one in Bismarck. His father was a dentist, whilst his maternal grandfather was a Democrat politician. Upon graduation, Bruce was determined to pursue a medical degree, so he headed out to the prestigious Stanford University in California, while Alice remained in Bismarck with another year of schooling left to complete. She attended junior college while also serving as a Sunday school teacher in her parents' church.
They shared this deep belief in God. They had more communication and approached their problems more maturely than most of the older couples I'd seen around school. They were a very special young couple.
The young couple continued their romance despite the 1,500 miles that separated them. Alice finished school and saved money by also working for the Duncan Perry Clinic in her free time. After a year of being apart, Bruce and Alice made a pact not to be apart from each other any longer. Their solution was to get married, with Alice moving to California to be with Bruce as he completed his studies. At first, her family wasn't too happy about the couple's decision. They felt they weren't old enough to get married just yet, being just 19 and 20 years old. Not to mention California was really far away from the family. But eventually the family gave way and the couple tied the knot on August the 17th, 1974, with a big wedding at the Bismarck Reformed Church, full of friends, family, and well-wishers. Following their honeymoon, the newlywed couple made the move to Stanford. Mr. and Mrs. Perry drove their car and left their hometown for good. But it never occurred to the Dykema family that as they waved off the couple in their station wagon, that it would be the last time that they would ever see Alice alive again. Now, before we follow this story out to California, let's backtrack a little and talk about that year that the couple spent apart. The 12 months that Bruce was in Stanford alone and Alice was completing her education. Well, during this time, Alice encountered members of the Process Church of the Final Judgment, who were living across the street from her grandmother's house. Six young men resided there together: Father Christian, Brother Thomas, Brother Joseph, and three other men of the church, who were referred to as, quote, initiates. These men attempted to indoctrinate Alice into their religious beliefs, but Alice quickly realized and developed a disillusionment with their system of faith. She recognized their affiliation with devil worship and dedicated herself to proselytizing anyone involved with the Process Church, hoping to guide them away from Satanism and turn them on to Christianity instead. She was extremely persistent in these actions over the 12 months that she was home without Bruce. Brad King, who was a former classmate of Alice, said, quote,
"I remember seeing people dressed in priest outfits, but instead of white collars, they wore red collars and sported upside-down crosses draped around their necks."
So who were they? What was the name of their church?
I think they were called the Holy Order of Man.
The Holy Order of Man was essentially a denomination of the Process Church of the Final Judgment. During the early 1970s, the Process Church gained notoriety due to its reported association with the Manson family. The controversial church embraced a belief system that allowed simultaneous worship of both Christ and Satan alongside one another. Initially established in London in 1966, the church expanded to the United States and eventually reached North Dakota. Members were drawn to the seclusion provided by the hills and forests, and they held gatherings at Bismarck's Hillside Cemetery and a wooded area behind St. Mary's College. It was at these locations that numerous disturbing local reports emerged detailing the church's involvement in stealing dogs from nearby trailer park residents and sacrificing them in bizarre and macabre rituals. Some residents would later discover their mutilated dogs lying dead within pentagrams drawn around them into the ground. After a year apart, after their marriage, and following their honeymoon, Arliss then joined Bruce in the Bay Area as he began his second year in Stanford's pre-med program. The couple lived at the Quillen Hall, a residential unit in Escondido Village, somewhere specifically designed for married students on the Stanford campus. With Bruce's demanding academic schedule, Arliss found herself with ample free time. The new bride found her new surroundings beautifully serene and perfect for quiet, enjoyable strolls through the local neighborhoods and parks. But she quickly developed a growing restlessness and wasn't content as a simple homemaker. She felt lonely in the unfamiliar territory, and she expressed in regular letters to her family and friends that, quote, "Friends are hard to find here." She also wrote to her best friend in Bismarck, quote, "Many times I've been tempted to go knock on doors asking if anybody needs a friend. I guess we just have to appreciate each other and trust the Lord for new friends too." To occupy herself during the day when Bruce was away from home, Arliss took a receptionist position at Spythe, Blaze, Valentine & Klein, a local Palo Alto-based law firm. Getting the job changed the young wife's disposition, and she wrote to friends about how her married life with Bruce was all falling into place, and things were starting to really work out in California for them both. She found the California weather beautiful, and in her spare time between working and keeping their home, she liked to hike, walk, and jog around the university campus. It was inevitable for a religious individual like Arliss to also be drawn to the huge and grand Stanford Memorial Church, which was situated about half a mile from their apartment. Arliss frequented the church, which had become her sanctuary and a source of comfort and solace for her. Built during the American Renaissance period, the university's architectural crown jewel never fails to awe its visitors. This church was one of the earliest and remains one of the most prominent interdenominational churches in the American West. In more recent years, it was in the news several years ago as the location of the memorial service for Apple CEO Steve Jobs, himself a native of California. On the night of Saturday, October 12th, just 8 weeks after the couple had exchanged their wedding vows, the campus was relatively quiet, even though it was commonly a night where many students would head out to party. Arliss wanted to take a breather. She had been stuck in the house all day and wanted to take in some night air. She decided to go for a walk to the mailbox, as she had a new bundle of letters to send to her family and friends back in North Dakota. Bruce decided to take his head out of his medical books and join his wife for the evening walk. As the two were strolling around the campus grounds, their conversation segued into a discussion about who between them was responsible for checking the tire pressure on their car. It was a silly minor squabble, but Arliss became upset and told Bruce that she wanted some time alone. The couple didn't really argue that often. They were such a happy and positive couple. But Bruce agreed to give her space. So he headed back to their apartment, half a mile away, alone. Left alone, Arliss decided to head to the Stanford Memorial Church and went inside to pray. Several individuals recalled seeing Arliss enter the church. It was around 11 p.m. and the church was practically empty, except for Arliss and two other people who were sitting in the back. They noticed that she sat at the front pew of the church, on the left side. Moments later, while the two worshippers were about to leave at around 11:35 p.m, they noticed a man in a blue, short-sleeved shirt entering the church. They described him as around 25 years old, with medium build, imparted sandy blonde hair. At around 11:50 p.m, night duty security guard Stephen Crawford went inside to inform them that the church would be closing shortly. He came back 20 minutes later, took a quick look around, and found that it was empty. Crawford then locked the church doors. Security guard Crawford stated that he also completed a security pass at 2 a.m. and did not see anyone around. Meanwhile, Bruce was anxiously awaiting for Arliss to come home. He hadn't liked how he left things with his wife following this small argument. His fear lingered in the back of his mind. So Bruce decided to head to the church at around 12:30 a.m., knowing that it was really the only place that his wife could be. He found the doors locked and all the lights turned off. He checked the side doors and the back of the church, but didn't find any doors that were open. He then wandered around campus, hoping to bump into Arliss, maybe on her way home, or hopefully they had just missed each other and she'd already got back to their apartment while he was out. But when Bruce got back home, he found their place empty. He was worried, and when there were still no signs of Arliss by 3:30 a.m, Bruce decided to call law enforcement and report his wife missing. Police went to the church and found all of the outer doors locked and believed that no one was left inside. But the following morning, at approximately 5:45 a.m, security guard Steve Crawford found one of the west side doors was already unlocked. He knew he had locked them the night before and checked them again at 2 a.m., so this was puzzling to him. With a bit of apprehension, Crawford headed inside. The altar was intact, and there was no sign of a theft. But the sight that greeted him on the east transit was so revolting that it could numb the senses. Crawford made a discovery that was one of the worst sights anyone could possibly imagine to see inside a venerated place of worship. Crawford found Arliss among the front row of the pews, laying on her back, spread eagle, with her head lulled to the left. She was half naked from the waist down. Her blue jeans were draped across her lower half in a somewhat ritualistic fashion, with the trouser legs placed towards her head. Also near her legs were her sandals and panties, carefully arranged. They had been neatly placed. There were multiple deep purple bruises on her body, which indicated that she had suffered from a violent beating. Marks on her neck show that she had been strangled, with the bruises on her neck matching the pattern of her beaded necklace. A 5.5-inch ice pick was protruding from her head just behind her left ear, embedded so deep within her head that it wasn't discovered until her autopsy, the handle of which had been broken off and was missing. Her blouse was ripped open and her arms positioned across her chest whilst holding an altar candle pushed up between her breasts, breaking both of her bra straps. Another 24-inch candle was forced inside her vagina. It had snapped in half due to the force that was used to insert it. A final brutal act that desecrated the body of Arliss Perry. Arliss had not been raped, but a kneeling cushion beside her bore stains of semen by a man who had type O blood. Her death had been extremely violent. Some accounts claim that from a bird's eye view, Arliss's body was set in a certain manner so that the position of her legs appeared like a diamond shape, resembling a pentagram. A partial bloodied handprint was lifted from one of the candles. Arliss's eyeglasses were missing, and FBI profilers later believed that her killer took them as a trophy. Crawford immediately notified police that he had found a female's body dead inside the church. The police dispatcher said that his call was odd, as he said, quote, "Hey, we've got a stiff here." A classy gent. Crawford reiterated to law enforcement that he had locked up the church shortly after midnight and made sure that the doors were secure. He verified this again at around 2 a.m. The Santa Clara Sheriff's Department, which had criminal jurisdiction over Stanford University, arrived to investigate. The police quickly determined that the unlocked west side door had been forced open from the inside, indicating that this was an escape route. Santa Clara County Sheriff Tom Rosa described the slaying as, quote, "a typical sexual psychopathic killing." Rumors began to immediately circulate on campus that Arliss had fallen victim to a satanic torture rite known as a black mass. But Sheriff Rosa was quick to refute these claims. He stated that the incident lacked any cult-like undertones in his opinion, and it had merely occurred within a church setting. Others, however, were not so sure. There were no signs of a struggle, and this led detectives to believe that Arliss had fallen victim to a swift and sudden, albeit vicious, attack as she entered the church around midnight. Much of what happened to her body, police stated, appeared to have happened after her death. Bruce Perry was initially the prime suspect. The police subjected him to intense interrogation, accusing him of killing his wife because of an alleged affair. But Perry denied these allegations and took a polygraph test, which he passed. On October the 15th, a memorial service for Arliss was held in the very church where her body was found. A peculiar decision, in my opinion. Bruce was joined by his father and other family members, as well as the co-workers of Arliss, who were from the law office that she briefly worked at in Palo Alto. Interestingly, one of the male office colleagues was surprised to see the, quote, "real Bruce" at the service. This was because the colleague was one of the attorneys at the law firm that Arliss worked at, and he later told police that he had seen Arliss in an intense conversation with a man the day before her murder. The attorney had assumed, mistakenly, that the man was Arliss's husband, Bruce. He was described as having a medium build, about 5'10", with sandy blonde curly hair. Arliss didn't reveal the man's identity to her colleagues, and also didn't tell her husband about him either. The description of the man seen talking to Arliss resembled the man that witnesses had seen entering the church shortly after Arliss had gone inside. Neither the man at the church nor the visitor at Arliss's workplace have ever been identified. On October the 18th, Arliss was laid in her final resting place back in Bismarck, North Dakota. Her funeral was attended by the grieving and outraged Dykema and Perry families, hundreds of friends, colleagues, and townsfolk who all adored 19-year-old Arliss. The investigation focused on the two people who had last seen her, her husband Bruce, and security guard Stephen Crawford, who discovered her body. As I stated, Bruce took a polygraph test, which he effortlessly passed, and was completely cooperative with law enforcement. He even provided blood samples for the police, although this was the days before DNA analyzing technology. Bruce was eventually ruled out as the possible killer of his wife. The stains on the pillow found near Arliss's dead body and the palm print from the candle didn't match up with either Bruce or Crawford. The police felt that if Crawford completed all of his checks at the 2-hour intervals he was scheduled to, then he would have likely stumbled into the killer or the crime as it was happening. Thus, the police felt that he had lied initially, possibly about not making his checks at 2 a.m. But did he lie? And who really was Stephen Crawford? Was he a reliable witness? Well, Crawford was a United States Air Force veteran who started working as an armed police officer of the Stanford Police Department of Public Safety. In 1971, when a new police chief completely revamped the department, 75% of the officers, including Crawford, were made redundant. Or for our US and Canadian listeners, they were forced out of their positions for compensation. Those made redundant were offered jobs as security guards instead. And this is how Crawford came into his post. Stephen Crawford was eventually ruled out as the possible killer of Arliss II. The stains on the pillow found near Arliss's dead body and the palm print from the candle didn't match up with either Bruce Perry or Crawford. It's worth adding, for transparency, that Stephen Crawford got into some legal trouble in 1992 when he was arrested and charged with stealing hundreds of valuable items from Stanford University's library collection, including Western-style bronze statues and rare books. He spent a short amount of time in prison for this offence. Shortly after his release from prison in 1993, he moved to San Jose, California, in an area just off Highway 85 at 5200 Camden Avenue. He moved into the first floor of the Del Coronado apartment complex, where he lived in apartment 185 ever since. I'm not doxing the guy. He's deceased as of 2026. Crawford's neighbors found him to be a normal and friendly person, although he mostly kept to himself. His landlord said that the ex-security guard hadn't worked for some time and was dependent on either Social Security or his retirement to pay his rent and bills. But jumping back to the murder case, by the end of 1974, the case had become cold. The unsolved murder of Arliss Perry gave rise to various conspiracy theories suggesting that her death was not the work of a lone psychopath, but rather the result of a satanic cult that had been stalking her from Bismarck, North Dakota. The positioning of Arliss's body with her legs spread and candles inserted into her breasts and vagina led those familiar with the cult practices to speculate that this was a ritualistic killing. Adding fuel to the speculation were cryptic messages from David Berkowitz, the son of Sam Killer from New York City. In correspondence that Berkowitz had made with authorities in North Dakota, he talked of the Arliss Perry murder, and he claimed to have information about the killer, whom he referred to as Manson No. 2. In 1979, 5 years after the murder, Berkowitz sent a book to North Dakota police with a margin note stating, quote, "Arliss Perry, hunted, stalked and slain, followed to California, Stanford University." Berkowitz insinuated that he was not the sole perpetrator of the New York murders and hinted at his involvement in a larger satanic cult. Detectives later interviewed Berkowitz regarding Perry's murder, but concluded that he had no valuable information to share. However, some followers of the case believed that Berkowitz should have been subjected to a more rigorous interrogation. The Manson No. 2, referenced by Berkowitz, was a man named William Mentzer, a suspected figure in the Son of Sam cult, who had connections to both the Manson family and was also, for a short time, a suspect in the Zodiac murders. In my personal opinion, Mentzer couldn't have been the Zodiac, but that's for another episode. Mentzer's potential involvement in Arliss Perry's murder, however, may be tied to his alleged participation in a group of hitmen who were associated with the Process Church of the Final Judgment. You see, law enforcement believed that Mentzer had carried out assassination assignments in the early to mid-1970s for senior members of the church who needed someone eliminated. Mentzer was later arrested for his involvement in the brutal murders of Roy Radin in 1983 and June Mincher, a Hollywood prostitute and madam. In 1984, Radin was shot more than 20 times in the head, and Mentzer placed a stick of dynamite in his mouth, which blew off his face. Homicide detective Carlos Avila said Roy Radin was marched up a hill at gunpoint and then executed in such a brutal way that when the body was found, it bore little resemblance to a human being. But despite these connections, law enforcement could not find sufficient evidence to directly link Mentzer to being the Zodiac killer, and he was never questioned about Arliss Perry's murder either. Despite circulating rumors, crime writer Maury Terry, who was investigating the Son of Sam killer's links to a wider satanic cult, took it upon himself to investigate Arliss Perry's murder too and retrace her steps. Through Terry's research, he postulated that up to four individuals were involved in her death. According to Terry, The sandy-haired man who visited Perry at the law firm was a cult member from Bismarck, someone that she knew from the Process Church. Terry stated that he had found evidence that Arliss stumbled upon information or witnessed something that she shouldn't have, which posed a threat to the cult. Terry believed that someone in Bismarck approved her murder, and they had connections to seek assistance with the act on the West Coast, indicating a level of sophistication in their operation. As for Bruce Perry, well, he went on to establish a successful career as a researcher in children's mental health and neurosciences, gaining international recognition in his field. Curiously, Perry's murder was not an isolated incident. It was part of a series of unsolved murders that occurred in and around the Stanford campus during the early 1970s. So this added to the perplexing nature of the case, because these homicides raised concerns about a possible serial killer at large in the area. Arliss Perry's murder marked the fourth such incident in less than 2 years, with three of the victims being young women who were alone at the time of the attacks. This series of killings began with Leslie Marie Perloff, a 21-year-old Stanford history graduate and Palo Alto law librarian. She went missing on February 13, 1973, after leaving her workplace. 3 days later, her dead body was discovered in the foothills behind the campus. Perloff had been strangled and a scarf was tightly wrapped around her throat. There were no signs of a struggle near her body, suggesting that she had walked to that location voluntarily, although her skirt was pulled up and her panties were stuffed into her mouth. There was no evidence of a sexual assault. Her body was discovered laid out again in a ritualistic manner. During the search for Perloff, the body of Mark Rosewald, a 25-year-old man from Palo Alto, was also found. Rosewald's death was initially believed to be a suicide and was not directly linked to Perloff's murder. Perloff was last seen at the Stanford University campus quarry gate, engaging in a conversation with a man who had long blonde hair. 7 months after Perloff's murder, another tragic incident occurred. David S. Levine, a physics student, was found stabbed to death on a walkway east of the Meyer Undergraduate Library. The attack was estimated to have taken place between 1 and 3 a.m. Levine's body, discovered by an early morning jogger, showed 15 stab wounds to the back and side. Similar to the previous cases, there was no signs of a struggle, again indicating that the victim had been caught off guard. Robbery was ruled out as a motive since Levine's wallet remained in his trouser pocket. Levine was described as a brilliant student with strong and consistently high grades. San Francisco Mayor Joseph Ailotto expressed his belief that the murders could be connected to a cult known as the Death Angels. This cult was suspected in the infamous zebra killings in San Francisco. 3 months after Levine's murder, another murder occurred on the UC Berkeley campus, which was also rumored to be the work of the Death Angels. The Death Angels were a genocidal black Muslim faction consisting of four black men: Manuel Moore, Larry Green, Jesse Lee Cooks, and JCX Simon. According to records, the group committed at least 15 murders, although some sources suggest that involvement may be in as many as 270 deaths. However, it's worth noting that the Death Angels primarily used .32 caliber pistols for point-blank shootings, whereas the attacks on Perloff and Levine involved strangulation and stabbing respectively. The MOs were significantly different. On March 24, 1974, Janet Ann Taylor, the 21-year-old daughter of former Stanford athletic director Chuck Taylor, was tragically strangled while hitchhiking to her La Honda home after visiting a friend on the Stanford campus. Her lifeless body was discovered in a roadside ditch the following morning. Detectives investigating the case acknowledged the similarities between the murders of Taylor and Leslie Marie Perloff. But Perloff and Taylor had been strangled, although Taylor's assailant used their hands instead of a scarf. Again, there was no evidence of a sexual assault in either case. Both victims were found barefoot and wearing raincoats with their purses present. So the motives behind these murders remained elusive for investigators. Sheriff's Inspector Rudy Simpson admitted, quote, "We don't really know who we're looking for. It's a rough one. When examining the unsolved Stanford murders, there appeared to be no clear connection in terms of the method of killing. However, on the surface, all the crimes seem senseless and devoid of a clear motive." In 2018, serial killer John Arthur Gettrow was charged with Leslie Perloff's murder. Investigators linked DNA to Gettrow, which had been found under Perloff's fingernails. He was also charged in the murder of Janet Taylor. Gettrow was sentenced to life in prison in November of 2021. Previously, he had served 6 years in a German prison for the murder and rape of a 15-year-old girl. His father was stationed at a military base in Germany, and once there, Gettrow lured the 15-year-old Margaret Williams to a field where he assaulted and murdered her. After serving 6 years in prison, Gettrow returned to the United States and lived in the Bay Area, near to his parents. In 1975, a year after the murder of Janet Taylor, Gettrow was charged with the rape of a female explorer scout while he was volunteering as the troop leader. The charge was pled down to a misdemeanor statutory rape. Gettrow was charged with a 6-month sentence in county jail, a $200 fine, and 2 years of probation. But instead, he ultimately received 5 months of a suspended sentence and served the remaining 30 days in jail on weekends. During the time he committed the murders of Janet Taylor and Leslie Perloff, Gettrow lived near the Stanford campus and worked as a cardiology technician at Stanford Hospital. Additionally, it seemed like Arliss may have been acquainted with her killer. Her meetings with a sandy head man at work or in church could have been pre-arranged encounters. The prevailing speculation suggested that Arliss Perry was meeting someone, possibly the enigmatic sandy-haired man. The identity of this individual, and how they got to know each other, remains a mystery to this day, however. What was intriguing is that the police overlooked the potential cult connection and the distorted religious undertone surrounding the murder. The police remained disinterested in pursuing that line of inquiry that led to the Process Church in Bismarck. But back in Bismarck, rumors circulated about a satanic cult allegedly involving prominent individuals who engaged in gruesome rituals at Pioneer Park and the caves behind the Catholic University of Mary. I reference back to the comments made earlier by Brad King about what he saw and the individuals that came to Bismarck. John Martinson, a former psychology professor, acknowledged the existence of peculiar religious stories during the time, but believes that Arliss was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. Following the release of Murray Terry's book titled, quote, "The Ultimate Evil," students in Bismarck began searching for signs of satanic activity around the University of Mary. However, no hard evidence was found, and the caves behind the university were eventually filled in. Nevertheless, Terry remained steadfast in his belief that David Berkowitz, the son of Sam Killer, possessed knowledge that the police neglected to investigate. Berkowitz himself alluded to connections with the University of Mary, mentioning cult activities there nearly 8 years before Terry's book was published. Terry further confirmed the occurrence of rituals at the university. During the 1970s, Detective Ken Kahn, who interviewed Berkowitz at the Attica State Prison, found the notorious killer to be evasive and uncooperative regarding specific details. This led Kahn to believe that Berkowitz may have been toying with the crime writer and had no knowledge of Perry's or any other murders at Stanford. But Martinson and Terry firmly maintained that Berkowitz possessed vital information, citing his documented presence near the nearby Minot Air Force Base in the months before committing his own murders. I recorded a 3-part series on the Process Church of the Final Judgment, where I dug deeper into David Berkowitz's links to the church, cult members, and his links to North Dakota. The trilogy is titled, quote, "Satan and the Process." Head back and check it out if you haven't already. When shown photographs of individuals believed to be involved in Perry's murder, Berkowitz identified one of the men as someone he had encountered during his satanic cult meetings in Minot, North Dakota. According to journalist Murray Terry, Arliss was targeted by a Bismarck satanic cult for murder. Because she had gone to Mandan, North Dakota, to try and convert satanic worshippers to Christianity, thus she was marked for death. According to Terry, the cult in North Dakota operated between the years of 1972 to 1976. Terry wrote, quote, "The cult's existence in a wooded area behind Mary College has been confirmed by at least 10 people, including police officers, area residents, nuns who taught at Mary College, and other Bismarck citizens who were involved in Christian activities." Importantly, the latter sources belong to the same religious organizations as Arliss did, namely Young Life and the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. A nun reportedly told Terry, quote, "My students knew all about the cult. They said the cult used to kill dogs during Black Mass meetings. We have a large cross here at the graveyard, and the devil worshippers used to creep up the hill to spit and desecrate our cross." The Reverend Don Deacock, who was the pastor of the church Arliss attended, admitted that the rumors about a satanic cult had persisted in the area for a long time. A lot of the cult activity had been rumored at the Minot Air Force Base, too, which brings us full circle back to serial killer David Berkowitz, who stated in 1979 that he was at a cult meeting in Minot where an individual got up and spoke about killing Arliss Perry. Berkowitz wrote, quote, "Minot happens to be the second most important point of the new Son of Sam investigation. Why did I write about Mrs. Perry? Simply because I had already known where she once lived, and I also knew that the murder was done by a cult. It was not a sex killing." Berkowitz knew all of this and other information about the Arliss murder years before it hit the press and featured in Murray Terry's book. The only way he could have this information was if it was first-hand from those involved. But why didn't police take him seriously? Why did the police refuse to investigate the cult angle? The pieces of the puzzle continued to elude the investigators, and the quest for the truth surrounding Arliss Perry's murder and potential cult involvement persisted, despite the detectives' hopes of utilizing advanced DNA technology and handprint databases to generate leads. But the identity of the individual who left behind the semen and bloody handprint remained a mystery for over four decades. Arliss Perry's parents tried to maintain contact with the Santa Clara Sheriff's Department for over 30 years, seeking updates and pursuing justice for their daughter. The murder had taken a severe psychological toll on Arliss's father, Marvin. He died before he could find out the identity of Arliss's killer, which was his dying wish. But only 3 months after his death, there finally came a break in the case. Santa Clara County Sheriff Laurie Smith, who was obsessed in solving Arliss Perry's case, stated that Stephen Crawford wasn't a retired suspect just yet. In fact, he'd been on top of the list since 1974. Nothing had ever cleared him completely, in her view. There just wasn't enough evidence to charge him with a crime. Through the decades, the murder of Arliss had been in danger of being closed, but thanks to the advancements in DNA testing methods, investigators believed that they could figure out who her killer was. And as they reviewed old components from the case, they zeroed in on the number one suspect, security guard Stephen Crawford. In 2018, a new DNA sample from Arliss's clothing was tested, one that could be examined in more detail, and it was compared to what was found on the altar pillow. Sheriff Smith said detectives were able to break the case through the new DNA evidence that now linked the 72-year-old Stephen Crawford to the crime. In fact, it enabled the investigators to secure a search warrant for Crawford's apartment. At 9:04 a.m. on Thursday, June 28, 2018, detectives arrived at Crawford's apartment with a search warrant and a name to arrest him. As authorities knocked on the door, Crawford asked for a few minutes to get dressed. It was taking him a long time, so the detective decided to enter using a spare key given to them by Crawford's landlord. detectives entered and immediately saw Crawford sat on his bed with a gun in his hand. As the detectives retreated, Crawford pulled the trigger, killing himself instantly. Crawford had taken his life with one shot to the head. Upon entering his home, detectives found that Crawford had thought of suicide for some time. There was a suicide note dated from 2016 that Crawford had written after he had been interviewed previously by a sheriff's detective. The note, according to Santa Clara Sheriff Smith, was hastily written and did not make any mention of Perry's murder. Perhaps this was Stephen's only way of eluding arrest and conviction, knowing all along that time would eventually catch up with him. Why exactly did Stephen Crawford murder Arliss Perry? Until the answer is known, her murder isn't completely solved. And is it possible that this man committed more crimes that to this day remain unsolved? When detectives searched Crawford's apartment, they found a copy of Maury Terry's Ultimate Evil hidden in a closet. The section about the murder of Arliss Perry was highlighted, with notes in the margin. This is Santa Clara County Sheriff Laurie Smith.
This case was really personal to me. She was murdered just soon after I started the sheriff's office, and it was high profile at the time. It's been frustrating throughout the years that we could never get enough evidence to charge the suspect. It's difficult for her family, it's difficult for the department, but we finally have closure on this case.
Was Crawford linked to the Process Church? What was Crawford's cult involvement overall? And had he ever traveled to North Dakota or been paid to kill Arliss Perry? The identification of Stephen Crawford as the killer of Arliss Perry only poses more questions. Questions perhaps that we will never know the answer to. But one thing is for certain, and that's the cult links that go all the way back to the Son of Sam. In the days before the satanic panic swept across America, was there actually a powerful satanic cult operating in the United States? How high did that power go? And is it still present in the shadows? Nearly 50 years have elapsed since the tragic murder of Arliss Perry, yet her memory endures. Peggy Swanberg, a friend of Arliss, said, quote,
"She was a good friend. I loved her a lot. She was serious and quiet, but she cared a lot about people. And what mattered to her most was the Lord and Bruce. I had watched her grow. I had seen how the Lord worked in her life. And I know she is now with him."
Good night, everyone.